Hello, I'm Richard Fieldhouse with the National Association of Sessional GPs' latest podcast. And I'm delighted today to be speaking to Martin from the Health Poverty Action Campaign. It's the we've just launched our 100th edition of the Sessional GP magazine, and with that we're launching our partnership with Health Poverty Action. So first of all, Martin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Let me just talk to you.
And so tell us a little bit about then Health Poverty Action and where you came to start your work with HPA.
Right, well, to answer the second one first, which is nice and quick. I've been working in the international development sector over about 26 years, originally a community development worker in the UK. So always had an interest in health, but not medically trained. So I've approached the work more from the poverty and the effects of poverty side, but now feel very much part of the health sector as Health Poverty Action. So Health Poverty Action, which is much more interesting, is an international development NGO that specialises in health. So we see, it's in the name, you know, we see a strong connection between health and poverty, believe that the two, each is a determinant of the other, and it's therefore incredibly effective to address both in an integrated and comprehensive way. So that's one of the things that drives our approach, one of the values.
So you're really starting at that very, very basic level. We're not talking about MRI scanners here or anything else. Like, we are talking about nutrition and sanitation and education at a very basic level with people in third world countries who don't even have that tiny level of provision of that sort of thing.
Exactly, because if you're working with some of the populations that have suffered the most extreme violations of human rights in the world, which many of the people that we work with have, and you're talking about their health, then the first thing that comes to mind isn't access to a doctor. You know, it's access to housing, it's access to food, it's safety from war, from violence. So medical care, it matters enormously also. But if you address the whole thing, so one of the other key things that drives our work, which comes to how we were started. So we were started by a group of doctors in 1982. And the reason behind it was that they were working with some other development NGOs, and they realized that there were a lot of refugees crossing the border from Afghanistan into Pakistan. But for the other organizations, for whatever reason, weren't able to go and work with them in Afghanistan. So Health Unlimited, we were then called, was set up to specifically to do that. And that fundamental principle is something that to this day still drives the places that we work and the kind of work that we do. So we try to work with populations that are otherwise missed out altogether. If you look at the way that development projects are set up around the world, put the pins on a map, you see a phenomenon that's called, we call it NGO clustering.
Right.
And you find that they mostly tend to work in the same places, which if you think about it, is completely logical, because there's factors that have led one organization in one part of the world to say, okay, we should go and work in this part of Ethiopia. Then probably those same factors have led a lot of others to the same conclusion. It could be that there's a good infrastructure there, you know, the staff are there, there's places to set up an office. It could be that it's been in the news, maybe it's been a natural disaster, funding might be available. So you tend to get a disproportionate focus in some areas, and then you tend to get huge swathes of populations are missed out altogether. And that's what we've always looked for. So we look at the places where everyone else is working, then we look at the populations that are missed out.
Gosh, so how do you find the unknown unknowns then? I mean, that's you set yourself a task there.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of it's down to local knowledge. We're very decentralised. So our head office, well, we have about 600 staff worldwide, which makes us a sort of a medium-sized organisation in the development sector. We only have 25 in the UK. So a lot of the leadership is local. So we have good local knowledge in country. But if we're working in areas where there's no one else working, then it's really important that we don't have a specialist approach. The metaphor that we'd use is to imagine being stood in front of a herd of stampeding buffalo. You know, and if you knew the buffalo that was going to run you over, and some magic hand could come out of the sky and pluck that buffalo away, then it would stop that buffalo killing you, but it wouldn't save your life because just another one would. And the threats to health for some of the poorest, the most marginalised populations in the world, are very similar. If you had a very, you know, if we say, okay, well, we will focus on malaria and that's it.
Got you, yeah.
It might stop people dying of malaria, but they're probably just going to die from something else.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the idea of an integrated approach, a primary healthcare approach, that doesn't just look at the health sector, but also looks at the other social and economic determinants of health, is something that is especially important.
And looking at some of the programs you've been involved with, I see you've even funding the purchase of cattle and poultry for people to feed them, and it's just very, very, very basic level. I remember seeing a film years ago called Kandahar about Afghanistan.
Right.
Do you remember that film? Anyway, but it was there was a doctor in that, and all he did was give, he'd made a diagnosis, had no medicines, but his treatment always was to give people bread, and that really struck with me. And that's kind of what you're doing it, and it fits in with that sort of the marginalised people. And I was very struck by when I was looking at your website, that you seem to get involved in a whole lot of other things. And when I first started hearing about Health Poverty Action and the AS1 campaign, I thought, okay, this has been probably sending in doctors to probably areas that you spoke of that is otherwise very popular with other NGOs. But you're quite different to that. This is I've not come across a charity that does this sort of thing. It's so interesting, and so it makes so much sense.
Yes, you know, we certainly. We would very rarely, we never go in and provide the services ourselves. It's all about education and building the capacity that's already there. Now, sometimes, you know, of course, we do send doctors into places where there aren't any. But it'll all be about, and they may do surgery work whilst they're there, but primarily it's about building capacity, it's about training. To make things sustainable. And when you mentioned food, yeah, it's what we would try to do. We would do that. We would distribute food sometimes. But we would try to do it in a way that also increased access to other healthcare. So, for example, in Somaliland, we have a food program funded by the World Food Program, the UN agency. But what we do is we do the food distribution from the maternal healthcare clinics. So what happens is that therefore increases the uptake of MCH.
MCH?
So, yeah, maternal healthcare.
Right.
So because often one of the things that I learned actually when I first came to Health Poverty Action, I heard a lot about the importance of healthcare being culturally appropriate, and. You know, of course, I thought, well, okay, you know, that's great, and that sounds a good thing. But if I'm completely honest, there was part of me that felt, but you know, if there's no healthcare at all, is whether or not it's culturally appropriate really the biggest priority? And over time, when I went on my first visit, it was to a maternal healthcare program that we're involved with in Latin America. And that was within indigenous populations. And at the time, my partner and I were expecting our first child, and we'd been having the training coming with our birth plan and, looking at the importance of feeling comfortable and as relaxed as possible during the birth process and all these choices that we could make. And in that, the traditional indigenous area, then It was very important. Firstly, the tradition is to give birth from a vertical position. There's a rope that is suspended from the ceiling.
What? Sorry? How does that work?
So the woman will hold the rope to support her to give birth in a standing position. Her husband will support her physically from behind. The tradition is that they... The nudity would be taboo, so they give birth in as a fully clothed state as possible. Right. The placenta is given afterwards for ceremonial burial because it has religious significance. And there are a range of cultural traditions that are very important. Now, if they were to go and give birth at one of the state health facilities, then the first thing that would happen is that they'd be stripped naked. They wouldn't have access to the vertical birthing facility. They'd be putting one of the on the you know, the legs and the stirrups on one of the the beds. They would the husband wouldn't be allowed to be with them. He would be banished from the room, and they would be a different ethnicity to the local staff, and so there'd be. They might be treated rudely, or might perceive themselves to be treated rudely. You know, but they would feel anxious about that.
And possible prejudice and discrimination.
Absolutely. As I say, you know, that would probably be present. And even if it wasn't, they might expect it to be, and therefore, you know, feel that it was. Hmm. And then the other thing is, they'd go through all this process, have with the health staff communicating. Solely through sign language because they wouldn't speak the language.
Oh dear, yeah.
So if you imagine, you know, the anxiety, yeah. What that experience would be like, when they go back to the community and tell that story, even if the birth goes reasonably okay, you know, no one's going to go back. So what I realised, you know, part of my education was realising that often healthcare that isn't culturally appropriate is the same as just not being available at all, and it, you know, it costs lives. So the cultural appropriateness and working with the traditional health workers, traditional birth attendants, training them and working with them to become part of the birthing process and bringing together the traditional and the state provision. Is a big part of what we do.
And that, again, in the article that that you've written for us, that Jessica's written for us, that goes out with this podcast. We've got a little story about the traditional birth assistants, the TBAs. But again, when I first read that, I thought, God, that's unusual. That's an unusual approach. I'm not used to reading articles about charities that actually take a traditional birth assistant. So again, these are what you would call a culturally appropriate local person, but it's more to do with the culture. It has pretty much no medical training, from what I gather from the article. But what you guys have done is actually given these very locally trusted people with great skills and hugely wonderfully networked locally, and you teach them some health skills that then allows them to then signpost and look out for danger symptoms and signs, then direct those to the appropriate health clinics where there are properly trained health workers.
Exactly, and that's all part of this locally driven approach for those.
But that's surely much more of a sustainable approach as well, because what we hear in the counter sort of to charities is often hear about specialists, as you mentioned, being dropped in into an area, do the stuff, and then leave, and then you've got nothing, you've got no, there's nothing sustainable there, no legacy.
Exactly. So you have a system that doesn't work brilliantly, but it's the only system that there is, where you have traditional birth attendants. They're trusted and they have access to the, they're in the community, they're available. And rather than, you know, try to ditch them and try to bring in a whole new system that wouldn't be trusted and isn't properly funded anyway, far better to build their capacity and use them as a bridge. To give an example, I met a mother with her newborn baby in Somaliland, And she had been, this I suppose is a good example, it illustrates the holistic approach, the continuity of care. So she had been having a problematic labour in a very remote village. And the traditional birth attendant had been trained as part of the project. So she recognised the problem. And another aspect of it was that she'd been given, provided a mobile phone and airtime, and twinned with a local clinic. So she, because of this, she recognised the problem, telephoned the clinic. Again, part of the project has been to refurbish that and re-equip that because it would only have previously been open 2 hours a day.
Gosh.
So it was then, it was open, it was available, and it had been equipped with an ambulance. The ambulance went to get her, took her there. They recognised it as something that needed a cesarean, which they didn't have the facilities to do. But the local city, the closest city, the project had also equipped the maternity ward there, so that that was again available. And all this for free. Previously, any services would have been chargeable, which she wouldn't have been able to afford. And an ambulance provided by that for the project, for the hospital, went to pick her up, took her there, and she gave birth the emergency cesarean, and mother and baby were saved.
Wow.
Now, the point is, the reason I say all of that is that if any single link in that chain had not been present, then it wouldn't have worked.
Mm.
You know, it needed to go all the way from the traditional birth attendant in the remote community all the way to the caesarean ward in the hospital.
It's health logistics, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah, and a lot of it's common sense. You know,
yeah.
It's. And I think one of the things that's so exciting about the AS1 campaign, and one of the reasons that we're so excited about the links with the Association of Sessional GPs, is that we believe very much that it's not about us here going out and providing our expertise to them. Their expertise is great. that we can offer solidarity, we can offer support, and that's helpful. But we can learn from them also enormously. And through the AS1 campaign, there are ways of sharing expertise in both directions. So, there's innovative apps where health workers in the poorer parts of the world where we work can seek advice from technical experts in the UK, but also in both directions. It could be that somebody in the UK maybe encounters somebody that they think is a victim of female genital mutilation and might want to ask some advice from somebody in Somaliland about that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Linkages.
Yeah, and on your website you list those three or four companies who sort of health tech type communication devices and education programs and teaching and learning that you can use to benefit and people on your projects. But it's interesting also, yes, of course, getting expertise from experts, culturally appropriate experts overseas for things like FGM, as you say.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. So, anything that's, all kinds of, the experience is so different.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We can learn in both directions.
So as well as our members being able to help our colleagues via these types of applications overseas, what other ways do you think that sessional GPs across the UK can help?
Oh, so many ways. One of the single biggest thing is to spread the word. I think more than anything, GPs, experience healthcare in the community setting. So this integrated approach to family health, primary healthcare approach. That's what GPs are all about. So I think there's a natural resonance with the work of a GP. Here and the work of Health Poverty Action. So to help making those introductions and I think education is important, again, in both directions. So, it's there's lots of technical support and, educational benefits that can be shared with people in resource-poor settings. But also, we can, all of us individuals, can learn so much about the cause of health, you know, the if we're going to achieve a world where everyone's health rights are recognised, we can learn so much about that from understanding more about how and why people are denied their health rights and sharing that with communities here. So, for, you know, for example, for a GP surgery to twin, you know, with, you know, Adopt Health Poverty Action's work as something that it can contribute to. And I don't just mean to, you know, to fundraise. We don't see, I mean, that raising funds obviously matters enormously, but we don't see that as money to Health Poverty Action. We see it as a GP surgery in the UK in direct partnership with health workers in resource poor parts of the world. That's the relationship, and we're simply an intermediary. You know,
okay, so are there any GP surgeries in the UK? Do they, in the same way that some towns are twinned with other towns in Europe, sometimes in churches you see a church will be twinned with another church in Africa or India or somewhere. So do we know of any GP surgeries twinned with health clinics across the world?
I'm not aware yet. It's an interesting idea, that. I'm not aware of a specific clinic to clinic twinning. Certainly a number will twin with Health Poverty Action as an organisation and support a number of programs in that way. But I think some of those direct personal relationships are part of what the As One campaign is about.
Yes.
So through that, you know, people can get involved in more direct, more individual level contact.
Because also we do have, over the years, when we started the NASGP 20 years ago now, there was just a couple of sessional GP groups in the UK, but now there's over 100, and these are locums and salary GPs, newly qualified GPs, get together once a month, once every other month, for a coffee, maybe for a glass of wine, a pizza, and talk. But what an exciting idea that some of those might want to get involved and again form some sort of relationship, either with direct with HPA or the As One campaign, maybe even in terms of a specific clinic. I don't know how that worked, but there's something very nice when it particularly to help one visualize, like my children have both adopt a lemur in some,
right,
it's a similar that sort of thing. I don't know that might
that's be an good. Interesting idea, or also a particular type of specialism. Yes, it could be,
yeah,
a particular interest in nutrition, you know, a particular interest in safe birthing. There's a whole range of ways of,
because you also do quite a bit of work with education, don't you? And on family planning, and there was I can't remember which country it was, but you managed to, as an Ethiopia, you increased the use of contraception from 7% to 60%, which is an incredible statistic. And again, I imagine not an easy thing to do when education is so important, and culture and beliefs and all that kind of thing can be standing its way.
Yeah, I think fundamentally what we do, it's about I think poverty more than anything else, and poor health actually, you know, usually, sometimes it's misfortune, but usually it's about lack of power. You know, people don't choose to be unhealthy, people don't choose to be poor. It's usually that they don't have the power to be in a different position. And access to knowledge is a big form of changing the power that people have over the determinants of their health. And we do a lot of education work, and sometimes in quite, you know, unusual ways. In Rwanda, one of the projects that we were involved with was setting up a radio soap opera, which we actually did in partnership with some of the Archers on Radio 4, and Ruth Archer, the Felicity Finch, who plays Ruth Archer.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and that was initially about HIV/AIDS, but then broadened out into other aspects of health education. So each episode will have a particular health education message. And it's targeted at the rural communities, and we have discussion groups in those communities who then discuss the storyline and feed back into, you know, based on how people are reacting to it, and that feeds into the development of how those characters move forward and the future stories. And that's become the most, it's now that it's the most popular, most listened to radio program in Rwanda.
Oh, congratulations.
So it's and the staff, who were formerly staff, now it's an independent NGO that we work with as a partner. But originally they were Health Poverty Action staff members who have become national celebrities. So it was, it's a fascinating experience.
That's wonderful. And you've also set up mother-daughter groups, and you've also done quite a lot with gender and sexual based violence as well, and a lot to do with empowering women and women's rights, which sounds also, again, when you mention about having power. And of course, if the caregivers in communities are so disempowered because of their gender, to tackle that at its root cause as well is such again a very, very inspiring approach to the work you do.
Yeah, and I mean, the gender dimension is massively important. That one of the things that I came across recently in the last time I was in Africa, in maternal healthcare, we often talk about the three delays. The delay in identifying the problem, birthing, delay identifying that there's a problem, the delay getting to the health facility, and then the delay getting treatment once they're at the health facility.
God, it's actually got a name. They call it the three delays.
Yeah, well, that's the term we use.
Yeah.
And actually, in this area where we're working, one of the problems was actually a fourth delay, was that the healthcare couldn't proceed until the husband had given permission. So the woman couldn't make the choice herself; it had to be signed off by the husband.
Even at the point of giving birth.
Yes. Yeah, and that can and actually getting that agreement, again, if it with difficult transport, difficult communication, can be a major problem. Let alone the basic human injustice.
Reflecting the Ethiopian story of going from 6% to 7% to 60% of uptake of use of family planning. With that background, is there again? That's just incredible work, and again, I guess that's just all the culturally appropriate local networks of people. No way could I guess Westerners going in could have ever changed that.
Exactly.
No, to that sort of degree.
Exactly. Yeah. So again, some of the harmful local practices. Some traditional practices are admirable, we could learn from them, but there are also some that are harmful, and to change those, so female genital mutilation is one, but there are others, for example, forced child marriage. One of the people that we work with that acts as a community educator, a woman called Aika in Ethiopia. She was forced at the age of 10 to be a child bride of a 60-year-old man. And she resisted that and was given by her family in chains to be his wife. And a long story, she escaped. She was she escaped and went to live in a different village with her aunt. But then the tradition was that her sister then had to be given. So the young child the decision. Such courage to go back to him in order to free her sister, and then she was beaten, she was cut, horrific experiences, and somebody that goes through that as a child could make so many different life choices. But the choice that she's made is to work to become a community educator to try and change these practices. And she, you look at her today, she dresses the traditional way, she eats the traditional food, she sings the traditional songs, she's a part of her culture, and she can therefore challenge these things and change these things in ways that somebody like you or I going in never could. So it's all about the change isn't something that we bring, it's something that local people bring and we're privileged to support.
That's wonderful, and that's a really lovely story to end on with. What Aika is now doing in that context. That's fantastic. And so, in terms of what our members can do, just finishing off on that, there are other things. Again, on your website, there's ideas about we can hold dinner parties and invite guests along to come and contribute towards HPA. You've got about 20, 25 London Marathon places a year that you can that people can get a charity place and raise money for HPA doing that. And on our events calendar on the NESGP website, we've listed an upcoming cycle event and a London 10-kilometer race or something that people, you have places for this. And this is, again, ways we can actually start to sort of raise money as well for the HPA charity.
Yeah, now there are so many things that people can do, and don't think about it as raising money for Health Poverty Action. Think about it as working in partnership with people like ICA in Ethiopia, because that's what you're doing when you get involved in supporting the work in that way. And know also that we're not an organisation with huge resources to spend on advertising and so forth. We don't get many offers of support like this. It's the partnership with an ESGP is really important to us. It's something we're very excited about. And when people choose to do something, it's not a drop in the ocean. It makes a massive difference.
Well, that's wonderful. And I hope everybody listening to that takes that on board as well. Martin Drury, it's been so good to talk to you. It's been so interesting to hear about the incredible work of Health Poverty Action over the years. Great that there's this, you've got this campaign, the ASWAN campaign, which is specifically aimed at doctors and health professionals supporting in partnership, and that's really great. So lovely to talk to you. Thanks again. And what we're going to do hopefully is over time maybe speak to you again, see maybe talk about some more stories, some specific campaigns, and we'll be keeping our members up to date with your news and the work you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much as well, Richard. Brilliant to talk to you.
Bye.